cast of The Wolfman, Universal did a lot more than round up the usual suspects. They went out and hired a number of the classiest character actors in Hollywood. The studio rightfully took a lot of pride in this cast, except for the Black Cat. None of the other Universal horrors used this opening credits gimmick of showing the actors in a clip from the movie. Claude Rains had a total of 4 Oscar nominations, including one for Casablanca. Warren William was a star at Warner Brothers throughout the 30s. Ralph Bellamy later won a Tony and an honorary Academy Award. Patrick Knowles was a rising star brought from England by Warners as a threat to Errol Flynn. Bela Lugosi was one of the top horror stars in Hollywood. Maria Uspenskaya received 2 Oscar nominations, and she was one of Hollywood's most respected acting coaches. And Evelyn Ankers and Lon Chaney were both horror stars in the making. My name's Tom Weaver, and you're going to get to listen to me for the next 70 minutes as I pass along important information like the fact that this shot of the forest that you're seeing behind the credits also turned up behind the credits of Ghost of Frankenstein, Night Monster, and The Mummy's Curse. Kurt Ziadmak was the writer of The Wolfman, and he says he did a great deal of research into werewolf myths, and he dug through a lot of old books before he wrote his screenplay. When we see the encyclopedia entry in a few seconds, notice that the word legend has been capitalized. George Wagner said that a Universal executive insisted on that to emphasize the fairy tale quality of the story. Also notice that the book mentions Talbot Castle without saying where it is. The Wolfman is set in Wales, but not once in the picture does anybody mention Wales, which is funny because in the script, Wales is mentioned in the dialogue many times, so somebody must have made a decision not to specify where the movie takes place. Ziadmak himself sometimes talks about the movie as though it's set in Germany, and at other times he slipped up and said it took place in England. You don't particularly think of Wales as a country that's steeped in superstition, but this is the most werewolf-happy town I've ever seen in any movie. It's almost like they teach it in school. By the way, before the story starts, let me point out that the one thing you expect to see in every werewolf movie, you don't see in The Wolfman. See if you can guess what it is. There's Claude Rains greeting Chaney. Claude Rains is an actor whose movie career was launched by a Universal horror film, James Wales's The Invisible Man, 1933.
Hasn't changed much, has it?
Not in 300 years, except for a few modern...
Here comes Ralph Bellamy. This terrific set was left standing and reused in a lot of later pictures. It's Dr. Frankenstein's house in Ghost of Frankenstein. It's Ingston Manor in Night Monster and so on.
You've got to get to work. See you tonight about 9, Sir John.
Fine. Glad to have you back, Larry.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Claude Rains is a terrific actor with Oscar nominations to prove it, but he's not a good enough actor to convince me he's Lon Chaney's father. They look like Mutt and Jeff in their scenes together. I want to know what Larry Talbot's mother looked like. At some point in this scene, Claude Rains says that we are a backward people, which turns out to be true. Most of the people in the village are very superstitious. So maybe that's why all the references to Wales were omitted, because Universal was afraid they'd be offended at the way they're depicted here.
Your brother's death.
That candle holder on the right was also used in The Raven during the Pit and the Pendulum scenes.
Sit down, won't you?
There's a correlation between Lon Chaney and Larry Talbot.
No, Larry
Talbot left home because he was the second son of Sir John, and therefore his older brother was the number one son. The older brother was going to inherit the title and everything else. Larry had the Talbot name, but it wasn't doing him a lick of good. So here's Larry Talbot with a family name that he thinks should entitle him to certain things, and it didn't work out that way. And Lon Chaney was, of course, the son of Lon Chaney Sr., one of the big stars of the silent screen, and Junior, naturally, wanted to get into showbiz too. And he probably expected his father to open some doors for him. But actually, Sr. discouraged his son. He got after him to start a business career. And Lon Jr. ended up a plumbing contractor. And in The Wolfman and in real life, somebody died before the son got what he wanted. Larry Talbot's older brother died, and now Larry, who got no respect before, is in line to inherit the estate. And in real life, it wasn't until Lon Chaney Sr. died in 1930 that Chaney Jr. could get into the picture business, which is apparently what he wanted all along. And who knows, maybe Chaney Jr. realized this about the role of Larry Talbot. Here he is playing a son who got shortchanged all his early life, a guy with a dominating father, a father doing all the things the son would like to do, a guy who wasn't allowed to be what he wanted to be. It would be kind of tough, I think, for Lon to play that character for 3 weeks without once thinking of his own real-life situation. By the way, 3 weeks is about how long it took to shoot The Wolfman. It began production on October 27, 1941, and they wrapped up on November 25, the 25th day of shooting. When they began, the title was Destiny, which is kind of a crummy title, honestly. And at some point late in production, the title was officially changed to The Wolfman. From the top of the castle, you get a gopher's eye view of the road. It must be a special lens.
Excellent.
To be honest, Sir John doesn't come across as such a hard ass that Larry would have left home to get away from him. At some point later in the movie, when Larry's really in anguish, somebody asks Sir John what he's more concerned about, Larry or the family name. And if some cold fish, stiff upper lip Englishman had played Sir John, the audience might wonder about that too. But Claude Rains plays Sir John in the fashion that actors always used to play American fathers in the Hollywood movies. Stern, but with warmth and compassion, which I think was the right decision. I think Larry's going to end up with enough problems without the father turning his back on him.
Well, I've got some things to do for
you. Now and then I'm going to refer to the Larry Gill version of the Wolfman script, and I'll tell you what that is. In an early version of the script, the Wolfman isn't Larry Talbot, the son of Sir John. He's Larry Gill, an American who's come to Talbot Castle to install Sir John's new telescope. For the first half of the script, that's about the only difference, the fact that instead of Larry Talbot, it's an American named Larry Gill, a visitor to the castle. And we'll come back to that later. Evelyn Anchors acted in some English plays and movies, and then she was on Broadway in Ladies in Retirement. Notice the half-moon earrings. Before she came to Universal, the studio gave her one American part after another, and she had to work very hard at losing her English accent. She had to say new instead of new, and record instead of record. But after about four pictures, she finally nailed it, and then Universal put her in the Wolfman, and she had to reverse the entire procedure. That story is part of an introduction that Evelyn Anchors wrote for a book called The Golden Age of B-Movies by Doug McClelland, where she also tells some great stories about the making of The Wolfman. The thing you might want to know about Anchors is that she and Lon Chaney acted together in a whole bunch of horror pictures. They were the Nelson Eddy and Jeanette McDonald of Universal Horrors, but they really didn't have any use for each other. The trouble started the day that Anchors was told that she was being given a new dressing room because Universal was so pleased with her work. She was thrilled until the first day of The Wolfman, when Lon Chaney came up to her all ticked off and he said, "So you're the girl who swiped my dressing room. You took it away from Broderick Crawford and me, and I think that's a hell of a thing to do." Anchors didn't know what was going on, but pretty soon she found out that what Chaney and Crawford used to do was take bottles into Chaney's dressing room, get loaded, hang all the furniture up out of the way, and then just fight. On Monday, she wrote, the cleaning crew was treated to a sight resembling a World War II battlefield. That, unfortunately, was just the beginning. Chaney liked to come up behind her, made up as the Wolfman, and he'd grab and scare her. And then during the making of Son of Dracula, there was a luncheon where Chaney and Anchors' husband, Richard Denning, nearly got into a fist fight. There was just always grief, and neither one of them ended up a big fan of the other, let's put it that way. Evelyn Anchors really had no interest in acting, and she was even more turned off by having to act in monster pictures. Evelyn's mother kind of pushed her into acting. Richard Denning, Anchors' husband, told me the mother was dependent on Anchors. Evelyn's dad had left them when Evelyn was a little girl, and the mother had to raise Evelyn. But once Evelyn grew up and got into acting, she became the mother's meal ticket. Anchors couldn't stand the discipline of the picture business. Her agents would set up interviews with producers for her, and she'd always be late to the interviews, and there were always hassles because she just wasn't into it. And once she dropped out of acting, she stayed out. Decades later, after the Dennings moved to Hawaii, and Denning was playing the governor on Hawaii 5-0, Anchors was offered the role of the governor's wife, and she just turned him down cold. She had enough.
That's funny. Another dog.
No, that's a wolf.
A wolf?
Mm-hmm. If you were to ask Wolfman fans what prop from this movie they'd like as a souvenir, probably a lot of them would want this wolf's head cane, which is still around and which has ended up in the hands of a Wolfman fan. Bob Burns is a lifelong horror sci-fi movie buff. If you know his name, it might be because he worked with Paul Blaisdell on a lot of the early AIP movies, helping make monsters for pictures like The She-Creature and Invasion of the Saucer Men. In the late 40s, Bob was a kid going to school with another kid named Sonny Berman, and Sonny's father, Ellis Berman, was a prop maker for the movies. Ellis Berman's shop was about six blocks from Bob Burns' house in Burbank, and Burns used to go over there after school and see Ellis Berman doing all kinds of stuff. In fact, around the time of this story I'm telling, Berman was building the dinosaurs for the movie Unknown Island, which starred Evelyn Anchors' husband, Richard Denning. And Burns got to see Berman making the T-Rex suit and all kinds of stuff for Unknown Island. Anyway, Berman had the head of the cane just sitting on a shelf in his shop, and Burns, being a Wolfman fan, recognized it immediately. Berman would let him play with it, and then one day he just gave it to Burns. Burns was, quote, just thrilled beyond belief, unquote. And he says that's probably what got him into collecting props and masks and so on from horror and sci-fi movies. In fact, he's got such a huge collection now that he's in the process of putting together a book about it. The head of the cane is made of rubber, vulcanized rubber, like the rubber of the tire of a car. I'm guessing that it was made out of rubber, because twice in The Wolfman, the cane is used as a club, so as a precaution in case anybody actually got nailed with the thing, it wouldn't do as much damage. And because it's vulcanized rubber, it's lasted all these years. It's still around today.
See you at 8.
No.
Here's our first look at Bela Lugosi and Maria Uspenskaya as they arrive in town, and also our first look at Maria Uspenskaya's stunt double. You can tell from the interviews that Lon Chaney gave that he was very proud of the Wolfman. He'd always say things like, "That's my baby," whereas he never had anything nice to say about The Mummy and most of the other horror roles he'd never talk about at all. Chaney thought that, next to Of Mice and Men, it was the best role he ever had. In a Castle of Frankenstein interview, when he was asked to name the role he found the most satisfying creatively, he said the Wolfman right away. Maybe that was because of who he was talking to. Castle of Frankenstein was a monster magazine, and maybe he figures that's what they wanted to hear. But regardless, the Wolfman was the first thing out of his mouth. And after he talked about the Wolfman, he got around to mentioning Of Mice and Men. Maybe one of the things Chaney liked about the Wolfman was the fact that, again in his words, the Wolfman was mine, all alone. He said that all the other monsters he played, Frankenstein, Dracula, the Mummy, he was doing them the second time around. They'd been originated by other actors. Chaney said in a 1962 interview that he'd played the Wolfman 6 times, which is wrong. He'd only played it 5 times. But it's interesting he said that, because maybe he was counting the Route 66 episode he did with Boris Karloff and Peter Lorre. He got made up as the Wolfman in that. And he also played a werewolf in a Mexican movie whose translated title was The House of Terror. Maybe he was counting one of those, and then again, maybe he just made up a number. He also said in the interview, quote, "All the best of the monsters played for sympathy. That goes for my father, Karloff, myself, and all the others. They all won the audience's sympathy. Why, the Wolfman didn't want to do all those bad things. He was forced into them." Chaney was one of those dream-slash-nightmare interviewees who never hesitated to make a good story a little better. In the interview where he talked about the best monsters being sympathetic, he also said that he played both the Wolfman and Frankenstein in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. He said that Bela Lugosi was signed to play the monster, but, quote, "poor old Bela," unquote, didn't have the physical strength to handle the role, so according to Chaney, he played them both. One day he'd play Frankenstein talking to the Wolfman, and the camera would be on the back of the head of the guy playing the Wolfman, and then the next day he'd do the same scene again, playing the Wolfman this time. Then, Chaney said, he did the same thing in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. He said that Glenn Strange broke his ankle on the second day of the picture, and so he, Chaney, did both roles. Quote, this is Chaney talking, "nobody ever knew about it either time," unquote. Nobody knew about it, beginning with Bela Lugosi and Glenn Strange, I'm sure.
Jenny?
No one knows whatever happened to Faye Helm. She's a very, very good supporting actress who has nice parts in a bunch of the Universal horrors. She's in The Wolfman, Captive Wild Woman, Calling Dr. Death, and Night Monster. She was also in a film noir called Phantom Lady. In fact, she played the title role. She is the Phantom Lady, even though, again, that's just a supporting part. Well. Kurt Siodmak told me there'd been some werewolf films before The Wolfman. Not many, but some. But none with that sharp definition of character. Actually, except for a few silent movies that I'm sure nobody remembered, even in 1941, there had been only one previous werewolf movie, Werewolf of London, Universal, 1935. But Werewolf of London, good picture though it is, just didn't grab people the way The Wolfman did. Maybe it was because Henry Hull, who played the werewolf, wasn't the world's most sympathetic character. Maybe it was partly the makeup, which is kind of minimal because characters in the movie had to recognize that Henry Hull was the werewolf. Actually, there are 2 werewolves in Werewolf of London, and Bela Lugosi was considered for the smaller werewolf role, but Universal got Warner Oland instead. I never quite understood this part. Lugosi is a werewolf, and he knows he's a werewolf. And here it is 3 minutes before the moon is going to rise. But he's open for business and reading fortunes just like it's 12 noon. Very inconsiderate. In case you're counting, I'll save you the trouble. Lugosi has 7 lines in The Wolfman. This is the one time Lugosi got to play a werewolf, even though when he transforms into a big dog rather than a traditional two-legged werewolf. In Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, Lugosi played the Frankenstein monster, and he got into a big climactic fight with the Wolfman. And then 5 years after that, in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, he played Dracula and got into a big climactic fight with the Wolfman. And then the same thing happened when Lugosi played a vampire in a Columbia movie called The Return of the Vampire. He had a werewolf assistant in that, obviously inspired by the Lon Chaney Wolfman. The actor even looks like Lon Chaney. And even at the end of that movie, Lugosi is attacked by his own werewolf. Lugosi just couldn't catch a break, werewolf-wise. The Wolfman is a crash course in werewolf-ology, Kurt Siodmak style. We've already heard Even a Man Who Is Pure in Heart 3 times. We've been told about Wolfbane. We've seen Wolfbane. And when we get back to the fortune-telling scene, we get an illustration of how the werewolf sees the sign of the pentagram in the palm of his next victim's hand. According to Siodmak, he read books and books on lycanthropy. That was standard operating procedure for him anytime he'd write a novel or a script to read up as much as he could. The interesting thing, the thing Siodmak is very proud of, is that the Wolfman catapulted werewolves out of European obscurity and smack dab into the middle of American pop culture. A lot of the werewolf rules and regulations that he made up are so embedded in people's minds, via the Wolfman and or all the movies it inspired, that it's hard to know now where the real werewolf myths leave off and where Siodmak's stuff begins. I think Siodmak has mentioned in just about every interview he's ever given that everybody thinks Even a Man Who's Pure in Heart is from German folklore, part of the actual werewolf legends. And it isn't. He just made it up.
Your hands, please. Your left hand shows your past.
In 1981, two big werewolf movies went head-to-head, and both of them acknowledged the Wolfman. In An American Werewolf in London, directed by John Landis, David Naughton is in bed with his girlfriend, Jenny Agutter, and he asks her if she ever saw the Wolfman. Meanwhile, in Joe Dante's The Howling, which is about a whole community of werewolves in Northern California, one human character is watching the Wolfman on TV and getting pointers on werewolves. The Howling also features the in-joke that a number of the main male characters are named after the directors of werewolf movies. George Wagner, who directed The Wolfman, is one of them, and other characters are named R. William Neal, Earl Kenton, and Charles Barton. They're the guys who directed the Wolfman sequels. The way that Bela's transformation spooks the horse is a nice touch. Later in the movie, after Larry's been bitten and he becomes a werewolf, there's a scene where a dog gets scared and barks at him, even while Larry's in human form. Universal liked that touch. Animals recognizing when somebody's really a monster, and it recurs in a lot of their movies, from Werewolf of London to Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, House of Dracula, Cult of the Cobra, and probably a whole lot of others. In fact, in Captive Wild Woman, Aquanetta, who's really a half-girl, half-gorilla, gets a job at a circus as an animal trainer because the animals are so scared of her, she can control them. Here's a nice gruesome shot of the wolf gnawing on the dead girl. I hope you're not listening to this audio commentary hoping that I'll finally be able to tell you why Lon Chaney turns into a wolf man, but Bela Lugosi turns into a dog, because I have no idea. I do know that Chaney once claimed that the studio, in preparing for this scene, rounded up some dogs that looked like wolves, but these dogs wouldn't wrestle with them and the scene wouldn't work. There was a studio watchman there who owned a police dog named Moose, and Chaney said, why not try him? Why not try the police dog, not the watchman? They did, and Moose gave Chaney a real fight because, quote, he was a smart dog who knew what to do. Well, this smart dog who knew what to do supposedly chomped down on Chaney's hand and broke the bones between his thumb and his forefinger. So Moose and me, we fell in love, Chaney said. I bought him from the watchman, and he is a very wonderful dog. Robert Boyle, the Wolfman's art director, says he went out onto the Universal backlot and found some trees and stumps and had them brought onto a soundstage. Once the set was properly lit and filled with this low-lying fog, it looked just great, as you can see. They chewed a scene on this very atmospheric interior forest set, and then for the next forest scene, they just rearranged the trees a little, or maybe just spin a few of them around, and it would look like a whole other part of the forest. Robert Boyle, who's still working, has 4 Oscar nominations under his belt, including ones for North by Northwest and Fiddler on the Roof. Look at that great, great, great face. In 1941, Madame Maria Uspenskaya was running an acting school in Hollywood, and one of her students was a girl named Dorothy Morris, who later got a contract with MGM. One day, Dorothy asked how old Maria was, and she was told, Madame is 55. This was around 1941. Well, Dorothy said she lived the rest of her whole life in terror of turning 55 because she thought that at 55 she would have a face like Maria Uspenskaya.
Big boy, isn't he?
Huge.
Like the Red Talbot, then.
We should have had him in the guards.
Oh, no. He'll be invaluable here. Looking after this.
Here's
state.
A blooper coming up here. You see the door open. And Evelyn Anchors and Chaney come in.
Here, what's the matter?
And the door is just being opened again. Actually, I do have a theory as to why Bela the Gypsy changes into a dog instead of a wolfman. In the early version of the Wolfman script, the gimmick was that you, the audience, or more accurately, you, the reader of old scripts, you didn't know whether Larry actually changed into a four-legged wolf or if he was suffering from the delusion that he changed into a four-legged wolf. Right up until a couple weeks before shooting began, this was the plan. And then somebody decided, oh, the hell with this, and they tossed out all the ambiguity and they added Wolfman scenes to the script. Well, during all that last-minute rethinking, maybe nobody realized that Larry got bitten by a four-legged werewolf and he turned into a two-legged werewolf. Maybe they didn't know how to fix it, and maybe they just didn't care, but that's my theory, that the four-legged Bela is an unfortunate leftover from one of the old scripts where Larry, in his own mind or in reality, transforms into a four-legged Larry. Coming up here out of the darkness is Patrick Knowles, who takes the pipe out of his mouth once, twice, another blooper, and Forrester Harvey, who's playing the timid Mr. Twiddle. Forrester Harvey was Una O'Connor's husband, Mr. Hall, in the Invisible Man. And funny enough, 5 years after The Wolfman, he was going to play a pretty big part in a Universal horror picture called She-Wolf of London, a female switch on The Wolfman. But Forrester Harvey died, very unexpectedly, during production, but before any of his scenes were shot, and Universal replaced him with Lloyd Corrigan. I might be talking through my hat here, but I always got the impression that George Wagner liked to use actors from silent movie days in small parts in his films, which is very plausible because he, Wagner, was a silent movie actor. One of his movies was The Iron Horse. He played Buffalo Bill in it. There aren't all that many silent veterans in The Wolfman, not compared to some of Wagner's later movies, but in The Wolfman, you do have Caroline Cook, and you've got Eddie Polo, who was a star of silent serials, and, among quite a few others, you've even got Gibson Gowland, who was the star of Eric von Stroheim's Greed, one of the great silent masterpieces. Gibson Gowland was also the big guy who led the mob after Lon Chaney Sr. in Phantom of the Opera. They caught him and killed him down at the Paris waterfront. And at the end of The Wolfman, he's one of the hunters who's on hand when Chaney Jr., as the Wolfman, dies. So Gibson Gowland helped to hunt down and kill the most famous monsters ever played by Chaney Sr. and Jr. Universal considered making a werewolf movie 4 years before they made Werewolf of London, and only recently have a few details come to light. In 1932, Robert Flory wrote a treatment called The Wolfman for Universal, right around the same time he was directing Murders in the Rue Morgue for them. It's set in the Tyrolean Alps, and it revolves around a child stolen and suckled by a she-wolf, and who in turn becomes a werewolf. This is how Flory describes one of the wolf attacks. Quote, "The woman struggles to the edge of the bed, her eyes fixed upon the door that is slowly swinging inward, nosed open by a long, deadly-looking head with glowing eyes and bared fangs. There is a sudden rush in the room. The light on the table is overturned, and there is the brief and terrible shadow painting on the moonlit wall of a tense, outspread hand thrown upward in extreme agony." Unquote. In another scene, the Wolfman, whose name is Christophe, undergoes one of his transformations while he's in a church confessional. Somebody in the Universal Story Department read Flory's treatment and predicted that millions of Catholics would be offended if such a scene was in the movie. Supposedly, the Flory Wolfman was meant to be a vehicle for Boris Karloff, whose Frankenstein had just been released and was turning out to be a big box office hit. Had the Flory Wolfman been made, then it would generally be thought of as the first werewolf movie. Most horror movie fans think of the 1940s as the decade of Val Lewton, and with a lot of justification. He was the RKO producer who, along with directors Jacques Tourneur, Mark Robeson, and Robert Wise, turned out a whole series of good psychological horror movies, very different from the kind of stuff Universal did. And for some reason, Lewton never passed up a chance to roundaboutly badmouth Universal. He tried to give the impression that he was just putting down cheap horror movies generally, but he was pretty transparent, and you could tell he was thinking of Universal when he'd make fun of movies in which a werewolf would chase a girl. In one article, he wrote that the horror film was the backward stepchild of the movie industry because, quote, "it has dealt so childishly and with such childishly unreal material. Too many camera tricks were used to show men turning into beasts and so on. Too little trouble was taken to make the horror psychological. Result, a limited audience, limited production budgets, mostly tawdry and unreal, cheap and uninteresting movie entertainment. By and large, it ranked with the cheap Western." To me, it always kind of sounded like sour grapes when Lewton would say things like that. I'll bet that what got on his nerves was the fact that he'd spend months and months painstakingly putting together movies like Cat People and The Body Snatcher, and then Universal would toss out one of their Monster Rally pictures and there wouldn't be a dime's worth of difference at the box office. But the weird thing is that Cat People, the movie that put Lewton on the map, is so close to The Wolfman that it might very well have been an intentional imitation. Lewton was signed by RKO in March 1942, around the time The Wolfman was probably getting close to the million-dollar mark, and the first thing that happens to Lewton there is that one of the RKO executives gives him the title Cat People and tells him to make a movie with that title. The movie Luton made involved a cat woman instead of a wolf man, so things were changed. But what's funny is that cat people did exactly what the unfilmed scripts of the Wolfman did. The Wolfman, right until about 2.5 weeks before production, and maybe even less, had the premise I mentioned before. The Wolfman would never be seen, except through Larry's eyes, reflected in a pool of water or whatever. And the audience had to make up their own minds whether he was turning into a Wolfman or if he was mentally disturbed and just imagining it. That's not how the Wolfman was made, of course. In the Wolfman, you see the werewolf and you know it's not a delusion. But a lot of dialogue left over from previous drafts of the Wolfman script is still in the finished film. Psychobabble dialogue where people discuss the possibility that Larry feels so alienated that he sort of hypnotized himself into believing he's a werewolf. There's more than enough of this sort of dialogue in The Wolfman to give someone the idea that a monster movie, a very good, interesting monster movie, could be made without a monster. And then Luton's Cat People comes along, and Simone plays a Serbian girl in New York, kind of a stranger in a strange land, just like Larry Talbot. And this movie also gives the audience reason to wonder if she transforms into a panther or if it's all in her mind. I don't think it's a coincidence. Maybe part of Luton's problem, part of the reason he often put down Universal horror movies, The Wolfman in particular, was the fact that he knew that he never got anywhere in Hollywood until he had copied one of them. The way this church scene was written in at least one of the early drafts of the script is almost too bizarre. Larry watches Bela's coffin being carried into the church, we just saw that. And it's covered with a sheet. After the gravediggers leave, Larry goes over to the coffin and removes the sheet, and there's a square hole in the coffin lid just above Bela's face, and we can see Bela. He's got a bandage around his head. The pentagram is very bold on his forehead. His eyes are open. He looks like he's alive, and he's staring at Larry with an evil grin. The gravediggers come back, and they carry the coffin out into the churchyard. At this point, Siadmak's script had the instruction that the camera should be inside the coffin, pointing upward as if from Bela's point of view, in order to create the impression that, quote, Bela is alive but unable to move, unquote. We've seen that in movies like Vampire and the Crime of Dr. Crespi, and it is a scary effect. The gravediggers carry the coffin into the crypt, and Larry's looking at Bela's face again when Maliva comes in, and she's holding Wolfbane. Larry hides and watches as she takes a flower from the bunch and touches Bela's mouth with it. The fiendish grin vanishes. She touches his eyes with the flower, and they close. She touches the pentagram on his forehead, and it disappears. Quote, Bela lies there, a happy smile on his face, as if he had found peace at last. It makes for good spooky reading, but I think Siadmak was kind of overdoing it, and I'm glad they left it out. Here's another famous ditty coming up here. The way you walked was thorny. It's no even a man who is pure in heart. It's no chart buster, but it's also very memorable and quotable and part of the Wolfman legend now.
But as the rain enters the soil, the river enters.
At the end of this scene, after Uspenskaya leaves the crypt, Lon Chaney comes out of hiding and he starts crying over Bela Lugosi's coffin. Film historian John Brunis interviewed an actor named Don Porter, and Porter, who was at Universal the same time as Chaney, said, quote, Chaney always liked to have a scene where he could cry. He had done it very effectively in Of Mice and Men, unquote. And Lon Chaney once talked about the Mice and Men screen tests. He said that some of the people auditioning for the part of Lenny played the role for comedy, and that others had played it for plain horror effect. Lon said, quote, I played it for tears, unquote. And needless to say, he got the part, and everybody thought he was very effective in it. So from then on, apparently, he liked to have scenes in which he could cry. And the Wolfman gives him a couple crying scenes. We're about to look at the back of an actor named J.M. Carrigan, who might look familiar because he's also in Werewolf of London, where he played Henry Hull's lab assistant. J.M. Carrigan was born in Dublin, and he worked as a reporter before he got into acting. He spent 9 years at the Abbey Theatre. He acted in London. He acted in New York. And he started making movies in 1916. His first picture was an Irish movie called O'Neill of the Glen, and Carrigan starred and directed it. That was such an early picture that the interiors were really exteriors. They'd take a wall or the ceiling off the stage to let in sunlight. In Hollywood, J.M. Carrigan was in a lot of classic pictures, and he was famous for never watching any of his own pictures. Somebody once asked him why not, and he just shrugged in a shy way and said it made him self-conscious. Okay, the Daughters of the American Revolution have started to act up. That's Doris Lloyd doing most of the talking. And off on the right, you see an actress named Adela Nesmith. She's in 1,001 movies, from Invisible Ghost and Return of the Vampire to some of the Val Lutons. And then in the 60s, she had a couple memorable parts on Boris Karloff's Thriller TV show. Most people's favorite thriller is Pigeons from Hell, where she was the old zombie woman who went around killing people with an axe. And she's also in The Hungry Glass, where she played the old hag who wants to be left alone with her mirrors. Adela Nesmith was also a Los Angeles TV horror host in the 50s, around the time of Vampira. She called herself the Lady Ghoul, and she was this demented, garbage-picking old witch. And one night, when she was hosting Frankenstein, she introduced herself as Mae Clark, the leading lady of Frankenstein, and she did the whole show saying she was Mae Clark. Adela has left the building, but we'll continue to talk about her. Of course, the next morning, the real Mae Clark is in a beauty parlor, and she overhears people saying how horrible Mae Clark looked on TV last night. She must be hitting the bottle, yada, yada. And Mae Clark gets sore, and she sues for $1 million. And if this isn't weird enough already, Adela Nesmith showed up in court in her Lady Ghoul costume, and she hammed it up on the witness stand. Mae Clark ended up settling for $7,000. Not quite $1 million. You notice the ceiling in all these shop scenes, an unusual touch in an old movie. Orson Welles did it the same year in Citizen Kane, and he got a lot of attention for it, but here they are in The Wolfman, too. Part of the reason The Wolfman is such a classy movie is the photography by Joseph Valentine, real name Giuseppe Valentino, who got into picture-making in the early days, 1918. He did a lot at Universal. In fact, his first four Oscar nominations were for Universal movies, and he worked for Alfred Hitchcock on Saboteur and Shadow of a Doubt and Rope, the famous Hitchcock gimmick movie that tries to give the impression the whole thing was shot in one take. Finally, Valentine did win an Oscar for Joan of Arc, which might have been what prompted him to take the next step. He announced that he was going to retire from photography and try his hand at directing. So there he is on top of the world, and I know you know where this is headed. He has a heart attack in his sleep one night at home. He died at age 48.
Perhaps the story I told you about the werewolf confused you.
Why does everyone insist that I'm confused?
And my next to last actor bio, Patrick Knowles. According to everybody, Knowles was a very nice guy. He worked under contract at Warner Brothers, Paramount, and Universal, and he once said that working at Warner Brothers was a training experience, that Paramount was just work, work, work. But he said that Universal was like family. It was his happiest film experience. Patrick Knowles was born in England, and he worked for a while at his father's publishing house before he got into acting. His big break came pretty quickly. He was in a play when he was spotted by a Warner Brothers executive and signed up to work at the Warner Studio outside London. That studio was looking to keep Knowles for themselves, to have him play in their movies. But Jack Warner, who was the head of Warner Brothers in Hollywood, saw a photograph of Knowles and thought he was just right to play Errol Flynn's brother in a movie they were getting ready to make, The Charge of the Light Brigade. Now, the funny thing is, Warner's tried to use Knowles to keep Errol Flynn in line. Warner Brothers told Errol Flynn to behave himself or he'd be out and Patrick Knowles would be in. Well, that wasn't going to work because Knowles and Errol Flynn knew each other in London and they were buddies, and Knowles was very, very contented just to be in Flynn's pictures, even in small parts. In fact, he hurt his career by doing that. In the Larry Gill script, Patrick Knowles is very gruff and jealous in this scene. He says things to Evelyn Ankers like, "Whenever another man talks to you, I can't bear it." He's like the British Ralph Cramden. When The Wolfman was first announced, Dick Foran, who was a cowboy actor at Universal, was lined up to play this part, but wisely, I think, Universal gave it to Knowles instead. Knowles, unfortunately, was one of several Wolfman actors who poo-pooed the picture after he did it. He was in How Green Was My Valley for John Ford right before The Wolfman, and he told an interviewer that he went from How Green Was My Valley to, quote, a Class B picture. It was one of those Wolfman things, just a small part. Universal placed him under contract while he was making The Wolfman, and he was in a lot of pictures there, including Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, playing a different part. Knowles worked right up through the 1970s, and then he retired, and he did a lot of wood carving, and unfortunately, he never wrote an autobiography, and he rarely or never gave an interview about his film work. Every time he was asked, he said he had a seriously ill wife he had to take care of. Well, this figures, right? The wife outlives him. He died in 1995. When The Wolfman was shot, it included a sequence in which Larry Talbot squares off against a trained bear. It would have been part of this carnival scene. A gypsy, played by actor Kurt Catch, walks into the camp leading a tame bear on a chain, and he shouts out, "Who will dare to wrestle with the bear? A florin reward for anyone who can throw him." This is all out of the script, by the way. I'm assuming it was shot just this way. After a few moments of hesitation, Larry drops his stick, jerks off his coat, and steps forward, a wild expression in his eyes. As Larry looks at the bear, quote, "He looks strange, tense, as if he were beginning to go into a trance," unquote. The bear gets scared and begins to back away from Larry. Larry steps up to it, his fists clenched like a boxer. Finally, Larry starts hitting the bear. Quote, his expression becomes ferocious, his teeth bared in a cruel grin, his eyes wild with the lust to kill. He looks more like an animal than a man. The helpless beast finally stops defending himself, and a last walloping blow topples him over. Larry rushes in to hit him again, unquote. At this point, Gwen steps in and cries out Larry's name, and he snaps out of it. And the crowd, which has been quiet throughout the fight, starts dispersing because they know they just saw something unnatural. According to an article in the Saturday Evening Post, the scene was supposed to end with the bear running away from Chaney and cowering under a wagon. The article said it took 2 days to shoot the scene because the bear wasn't cooperative. He had been hibernating, and the zoo woke him up for Universal. The bear was very grouchy, and he started to act up. And when that happened, according to the article, it was Chaney who ran and hid under the wagon. Probably the reason the scene was cut from the movie is because it shows Larry Talbot going loco even though he's in human form, and that doesn't fit with the rest of the story. Look up Maria Uspenskaya in the various movie reference books, and you'll find a number of different dates of birth, some as far back as 1867 and some as quote-unquote recent as 1887. Greg Mank, who wrote about her in his book Women in Horror Films, says he can believe the 1887 date, which would make her 54 in The Wolfman, 5 years younger than Bela Lugosi, who played her son. It does sound unbelievable, but she had the kind of hard life that would make somebody look old before their time. She was born in Russia, and in 1911, she joined the Moscow Art Theater, the home of Stanislavski and the birthplace of The Method. Uspenskaya was in about 100 plays there, and she taught drama, and she lived through Russian revolutions and famine and everything else that was going on at the time. Notice her half-moon earrings. In America, she did exactly what she did in Russia, acting in plays and teaching aspiring actors. She was in Dodsworth on Broadway with Walter Houston, and then Sam Goldwyn brought the two of them out to Hollywood to appear in the movie version. Uspenskaya got an Oscar nomination for her very first Hollywood movie, and then 3 years later, she was nominated a second time for Love Affair. Uspenskaya taught acting in Hollywood, she wore a monocle, and she was a terrible chain smoker. She smoked in her acting classes, she smoked at the studio, and she even smoked when she went swimming. She'd go out and splash around with a cigarette in her mouth, and when the cigarette went out, she'd go ashore, light up, and then wade back out again. And needless to say, she smoked in bed, which caught up with her in 1949. She fell asleep with a cigarette going, and as one insensitive film historian actually wrote, she went up in a blaze of luckies. She sustained second and third degree burns and lingered in critical condition for a day or two before she finally passed away, leaving an estate of $358. The 1887 birth date is on her death certificate, and it's even on her tombstone, which would make her 62 when she died. According to Greg Mank, more than anyone else in the cast, Maria Uspenskaya gives the Wolfman its power, its sense of classical Greek tragedy. The movie that's most like The Wolfman is called Bride of the Gorilla, 1951, written and directed by Kurt Siodmak. It's set on a rubber plantation in South America where Raymond Burr, who was then very much a Lon Chaney Jr. type, falls in love with his boss's wife and then kills the guy. But an old female servant, very much like Maliva, sees this, and she puts a curse on Burr. The idea here was the same as in Siodmak's early scripts of The Wolfman. The audience isn't sure whether Raymond Burr turns into a gorilla or if it's all in his head. Lon Chaney was in it as a policeman, and there's also the Maliva character, a wolfbane-like plant of evil. Raymond Burr gets caught in an animal trap, everything, right down the line. It's a disguised semi-remake of The Wolfman, although I've tried and I can't get Kurt Siodmak to admit it. Here's another piece of useless trivia. Remember back in the 60s when there were monster magazines that would take photos from old horror movies and give them crazy captions? There was a set of bubblegum trading cards that did the same thing, and one of them was a picture of the Wolfman in a tree looking down on Evelyn Anchors, and in the caption she's saying, "Sometimes I feel there's something hovering over me." Well, that goofy trading card is the picture of Anchors that to this day, Dee Denning, Evelyn Anchors' daughter, carries around in her wallet. This scene ends with what I think is the only screen kiss of Chaney and Evelyn Anchors. They look so comfortable together, you'd never guess they really had no use for each other. They're also in Ghost of Frankenstein, Son of Dracula, Weird Woman and the Frozen Ghost, plus some non-horror stuff like North to the Klondike, where Lon Chaney played one of his many, many bad guys. Another thing that confuses me about the Wolfman is, if Maliva had a silver charm for Larry, a charm that broke the evil spell, why didn't she give one to Bela? Anyway, Evelyn Anchors also remembered shooting the carnival scene with the bear and the bear getting out of hand. She said the bear came after her. Lon Chaney disappeared, as did everybody else, and she started running faster than she'd ever run in her life. She shot up a ladder, and an electrician grabbed her and pulled her up onto his platform. Quote, he then blinded the bear with a hot floodlight. The trainer finally caught up with the animal, retrieved his chain, reprimanded him, and gradually got him back down onto the stage.
Well, the gypsies are all leaving.
I must go, too.
But Gwen!
Hey, I love this guy here. There's a werewolf in camp. You lived with Bela in camp all those years, pal. Can't you tough it out one more night? Maybe they kept Bela on a leash. Anchor said that when the wolfman finally wrapped up, quote, I was relieved and happy that the gray hairs didn't show among the blonde. This montage of images was probably inspired by a similar montage in the 1941 Spencer Tracy version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which was a new horror movie when the Wolfman was being written. In Jekyll and Hyde, the montage was very elaborate and very Freudian. This one here in the Wolfman really doesn't compare. It's kind of a pile-up of weird images and previous shots from the movie. But it gets the point across that Larry's starting to really bug out. Coming up here is a great, creepy scene where Larry rushes home and starts checking himself out for wolf hair. The music's terrific, too. I love the musical pulse, like a musical heartbeat. Universal did the same thing in Bride of Frankenstein in some of the lab scenes, and it's a great effect. The music in The Wolfman is by Frank Skinner and Hans J. Salter, who between them had 11 Academy Award nominations by the end of their lives, and by Charles Previn, Andre Previn's uncle, who had 6 nominations and who did win one Oscar. There's a little bit of music from other movies in The Wolfman. There are some bits and pieces from Man-Made Monster, Chaney's first Universal horror, and some from The House of the Seven Gables, but probably about 90% of the music in The Wolfman is new. And then, of course, this Wolfman music ended up in many of the later Universal horrors. Some of it is even in Creature from the Black Lagoon. They even gave the Wolfman his own 3-note musical motif, which was later adapted and reorchestrated and reused in the later Wolfman pictures. In the Larry Gill script, you never see Larry Gill as the Wolfman, except in scenes at the end, and even then, you're seeing it through Gill's eyes, reflected in a pool of water out in the woods someplace. This scene we're watching right here isn't in the Larry Gill script, obviously, because in the Gill script, after the gypsy carnival scene, there's a fade to black when the gypsy tells Gill there's a werewolf in camp, and then it fades back in on the scene of the sleeping village being woken up by the sound of the wolf howls, a scene that's coming up in about a minute. In other words, you see Larry Gill all worked up and ready to believe anything, and then the next thing you see is the aftermath of one of the wolf murders. These great werewolf boots, or boots very much like them, were later used for the monsters in Night Monster and Captive Wild Woman. The art director Robert Boyle says the trees in this interior forest set were painted black and then coated with glycerin so that they'd pick up the light and look damp. Here's a good look at a tree, and a great first look at the Wolfman. Some fans complain about the fact that Chaney was in an undershirt in the last scene and now he's got his shirt on again. I say if you can accept that this guy turns into a wolf, then you can damn well accept he's wearing a shirt. The guy digging the grave is an actor named Tom Stevenson, and the grave he's digging, although nobody mentions it, is the grave of Jenny Williams, the girl killed by the wolf. There's an awkward shot in here where you can hear the wolfman howling, and yet they show him standing there with his mouth closed. Tom Stevenson played the grave digger in this movie, and he's the wolfman's first victim, but a year later when Universal made Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, he's one of the first people you see in that movie. He plays one of the two grave robbers who break into Larry Talbot's crypt. At this point, I have to start ignoring the action of the movie completely for a little while because there's so much to say about the makeup and the transformation scenes, and I can't cram it all into the few minutes that the Wolfman is on camera. I got some of the following information from Bob Burns and a great deal more of it from Michael R. Thomas. Mike is a makeup man and a veteran of 20 seasons of Saturday Night Live. He's an Emmy Award nominee for Saturday Night Live. He's worked on All My Children, The Sentinel, Ghostbusters, and on and on. More importantly, he's also one of the world's number one Jack Pierce fans, and he's completely fascinated by Pierce, and he's made a real study of trying to figure out how Pierce concocted and devised some of his monster makeups. Making Chaney up as the Wolfman. According to Mike, Pierce would start with the Wolfman appliances. Probably the Wolfman nose appliance would go on first. You can tell from looking at close-up photographs that it starts just above Chaney's eyebrows, and it goes down on either side of his nose, underneath his eye bags, and all the way down to his upper lip. The edges of the thing were probably sealed with cotton and collodion, which was something that Pierce used extensively. At this point, Pierce would probably do all the grease paint work. The next step, after powdering the grease paint, is in dispute. Michael Blake, an Emmy-winning makeup man and the expert on Lon Chaney Sr., Mike's written 3 books on Sr., Michael Blake's hunch is that Pierce did lay the rest of the Wolfman's facial hair on by hand. He says Pierce would have put spirit gum on a section of Chaney's face, taken some yak hair, held it in his hand, cut it at an angle, and then applied it to Chaney's face a section at a time, and then cut and trimmed it. That, by the way, is what the Universal Publicity Mill wanted people to believe, that Pierce glued every single hair onto the head of every single monster he ever made, that he started from scratch every time. Michael R. Thomas, on the other hand, believes that Pierce might have had a few ventilated hair pieces made. The technical term, he tells me, is lace hair pieces. They're like pre-made beards and mustaches and sideburns with the yak hair ventilated, or crocheted actually, onto silk or nylon net. Mike Thomas thinks that to save time, Pierce probably had several of these pieces made. For example, one to go around Chaney's neck like a turtleneck. I love the fact that Chaney tore out the throat of the gravedigger, but he doesn't have a drop of blood on him. Next would come the Wolfman wig, which would have been a very, very large one, going from very close to Chaney's eyebrows, over his head, and down the back of his neck. Most wigs would end at the nape of the neck, but this would have been different because the hairline would have been so much lower than the average wig. If you look at stills of the Wolfman, you can see that Chaney's eyebrows are non-existent because they're covered up by the snout appliance. And then the hairline of the wig starts just a fraction of an inch above where his eyebrows would have been. So the snout would go on first, then either the hand-laid hair or the ventilated hair pieces, depending on what procedure you think Pierce used, and then the wig. If you believe Chaney did use a few ventilated hair pieces, then the next step would be to dress all the edges of the hair pieces and the wig using more yak hair. Yak hair is a lot stiffer than crepe hair, and it has a lot more body to it, so it's more manageable. It's also more expensive, but it worked a lot better. Before I go on, I want to read a short item from the Wolfman press book about how Jack Pierce supposedly came up with the Wolfman makeup. Quote, 5 years of research, 5 months preparation, and almost 5 hours of daily work were required by Jack Pierce, Universal Studio makeup chief, in making the werewolf of Lon Chaney for the horror drama The Wolfman. Pierce spent 5 years combing countless histories of England in a vain attempt to find a description or an illustration of a werewolf. Finally, Pierce merely decided to create a makeup combining human features with those of a wolf.
No, animal tracks, a wolf. A wolf.
If it took Pierce 5 years to figure that out, maybe Universal was right when they kicked them out for being too slow.
Escape from a circus or a zoo.
Anyway, according to an article written by a reporter who was on the set of The Wolfman, Jack Pierce had a real wolf on hand at some point, and he used it as a model. And supposedly the wolf slunk into the corner of its cage when it got a load of Chaney and makeup. You can believe those two stories or not, I don't. The Wolfman hands were just slip-ons, like big gloves. When you look at some of the publicity photos of the Wolfman hands, you can see a seam around the fingers. Something like that would usually be made from a two-part mold. They'd get an impression of Chaney's hands, a palm and a back, and use that to make the slip-on Wolfman gloves. In one photo from Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, one of the sleeves of Chaney's shirt is riding up a little higher than it should, and you can see buttons on the side of one glove. So presumably the gloves in the Wolfman were made the same way. They'd slip on, and then you'd button them up and they wouldn't come off. Mike Thomas says that the fangs, which went on over Chaney's teeth, could have been made of wood or ivory or very hard dental wax, which is very sculptable. Mike Thomas's final theory is that the Wolfman feet were probably a collaboration between the makeup department, the prop department, and the wardrobe department. He thinks it's possible that the wardrobe department contrived something that would fit Chaney's feet, and then the prop department modified it so that Chaney could walk around on his toes without actually having to make the muscular effort of standing on tiptoe. These boots probably automatically pointed his feet and then made it impossible for him to bend his feet back and stand flat-footed. They were probably very much like women's high-heeled boots, without the heels and very form-fitting. These are just educated guesses, but you have to do some educated guesses 60 years after a movie's been made and all the paperwork and all the people are gone. The Wolfman boots seem to hold that position so stiffly, it appears as though they were built to be extremely rigid so that it would make it impossible for Chaney to walk flat-footed. Lon Chaney once said about his various monster roles, I guess I have the right yoga attitude about doing this stuff. It's terribly fatiguing and nerve-wracking. Several times they've tried making up stuntmen to relieve me a bit, but inevitably they couldn't take it for more than a few hours, and then it's up to Chaney again, unquote. And as if all this rigmarole of the Wolfman makeup wasn't enough, it was during the making of the Wolfman that Universal decided that Lon Chaney would play the monster in Ghost of Frankenstein, which was coming up, and Jack Pierce had to start measuring Chaney for wigs and all sorts of preliminary stuff for Chaney to play the monster, very likely while the Wolfman was still in production. There's Doris Lloyd and her friends on the steps of the cathedral built for Chaney Sr.'s Hunchback of Notre Dame, 1923. The only time in the movie that you see a Wolfman facial transformation is near the very end, but again, if I wait till then to start talking about it, I'll be talking for 5 minutes after the movie's over, so I'm going to continue to ignore the action. Lon Chaney used to give interviews where he claimed that, for the Wolfman transformations, he had to plant himself in one position for as long as 22 hours, while Jack Pierce put makeup on him and they shot a few frames, and then Pierce put on some more makeup and they shot a few more frames, and that's all a lot of baloney. Here's how they really did it, from the lips of Jack Pierce and Lon Chaney to the ears of Bob Burns and now passed along to us. Chaney would get into whatever position he'd be in for the transformation scenes, and he'd be given a headrest thing. In the old days of picture taking, in the old days of taking photographs, the days of old tintype pictures, the people being photographed had to stay still for like a minute or else they'd come out blurry in the picture. So they'd have their necks in headrests, and that way they couldn't move at all. On the Wolfman, the movie camera would be in position, pointed at Chaney, and then they'd set up two speed graphic cameras, what used to be called portrait cameras, one to the left of the movie camera and the other to the right. All three cameras, the movie camera and the two portrait cameras, would be pointing at Chaney. They'd triangle in on him like a big letter V. The portrait cameras would have 8x10 pieces of frosted glass as part of them, and then while Chaney sat, or laid, or whatever he was doing in the headrest, which helped them hold position, an artist would draw the outline of Chaney on the frosted glass of the two portrait cameras. They also had a frosted glass piece on the primary camera, the movie camera, and they drew his outline there, too. That way, they could photograph him for a few frames, and then he could get up and go get in the makeup chair and have a little bit of Wolfman makeup put on. Then he'd go back in front of the cameras, lay down, put his neck in the headrest, and then start repositioning himself and wiggling around until he matched up perfectly with the outlines drawn on the frosted glass of all three cameras. A few more frames would be photographed, and then he'd be free to get up again and go back into makeup again, and on until he had all the makeup and all the transformation was done. How long did it take? We don't know. All the behind-the-scenes paperwork and daily production reports related to the Wolfman are lost or destroyed, but it had to be a long process. Just to put the Wolfman makeup on for an ordinary scene of Chaney running around through the woods probably took about 4 hours. And when I say 4 hours, I mean 4 hours of Jack Pierce doing nothing but working on Chaney. So now add to that 4 hours all the time involved in lining Chaney up for the various shots and having him go back and forth from the stage to makeup over and over and over. Also, Pierce had to do the makeup differently when he was doing the transformation scenes. It's doubtful that Pierce just kept on applying makeup on top of makeup on top of makeup. It appears that, especially when it came time to put that wolf snout on, it's a good guess that the makeup that Pierce had already applied had to be removed, and then, after putting the snout on, the makeup would be reapplied. 6 or 7 stages of transformation, 6 or 7 dissolves, is an enormous amount of time. I interviewed an actor named Mark Richman, who transformed into a monster in a 1965 Universal movie called Dark Intruder, and his recollection was that that little scene took 15 hours, and between each stage of the transformation, it was back and forth to the makeup room, where he had 5 or 6 guys working on him. Another thing Chaney used to say was that for scenes of his hands changing at the wolf claws, they'd get little tacks, and they'd nail his fingertips to the floor, or to whatever, so they wouldn't move during the process. I was a little kid when I first read that, and even then I knew that couldn't have been the way they did it. Actually, the hands would be done the same way as the headshots with the different cameras, and as a matter of fact, for a shot of a hand changing or a shot of feet changing or whatever, it wouldn't even be Chaney. They'd get a stand-in. Robert Skotak, who's the Oscar-winning special effects artist of Aliens and Terminator 2, tells me that the main mechanical effects guy at Universal was a guy named Charlie Baker, and one of the things Charlie Baker would do is supervise the miniatures. Probably the miniature of Talbot Castle that we saw at the beginning was Baker's. And according to Baker, his hand had the right character, the right look, and occasionally when just a hand or hands were involved in a transformation scene, he'd be the stand-in. This business of the three cameras is actually a pretty easy, common-sensible way to do the transformation scenes, but it's also very effective. And as they went along, they came up with other clever ideas, like in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, where Chaney's in the hospital bed and he transforms into the Wolfman. For that scene, the pillow that his head is on was actually plaster of Paris with cloth over it, cloth probably glued to it, and that way the wrinkles never changed. That's another trade secret that Bob Burns got directly from Jack Pierce.
All right, sir. Last one, huh?
That ought to hold him.
Coming up here is a nice shot of the forest. followed by a repeat shot of the Wolfman on the prowl that we just saw a couple of minutes ago. Like I said, the paperwork on the making of the Wolfman is all gone, but we do know a little about the Wolfman transformation scenes in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, which might be interesting. The entire scene of Chaney in the London hotel room talking to Lou Costello on the phone at the beginning of the picture was not directed by Charles Barton, who directed the rest of the movie. It was directed by a guy named Jack Hively. Hively came in on a Monday to shoot the scene of Chaney transforming into the Wolfman. Chaney collapses into a chair, and there's a close-up on him as he changes. They started shooting that transformation at 9 in the morning, alternately shooting, making Chaney up, shooting, making Chaney up, and they took a break for lunch, and then they shot until 5:15 in the afternoon. That's almost 8 hours, and still they weren't done. They came back the next day, started shooting at 9:50, and finished the transformation scene at noon. And after that, they shot the scene of Chaney running around the apartment and ripping up the chair and all that other good stuff. So that transformation scene of Chaney in the chair took 10 hours, spread out over 2 days. So Chaney's stories that he had to stay in one position for 22 hours, he couldn't even go to the bathroom, that's all nonsense. I mean, he went home in the middle of shooting that hotel scene. Unfortunately, there isn't as much information about the other Wolfman transformation in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, the scene where Chaney falls on the ground and changes in the woods. That appears to have been shot all in one day. It seems like that transformation might have been shot in 11 hours, but there's a little bit of guesswork involved on that one, so don't quote me on that. Now, from the not-so-funny department, Chaney attempted to commit suicide shortly after Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein was made, and his wife blamed it on the Wolfman. She said he was so emotionally exhausted from having gone through the makeup transformation on Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein that that's why he tried to do himself in. A close friend of Chaney's was quoted in the Los Angeles Examiner saying that Chaney was very near collapse from overwork due to the ordeal of roles in which he tried to follow the grueling characterizations originated by his father. He'd recently worked as the Wolfman in a series of shots which required him to stand in trying positions, virtually motionless, for 8 to 10 hours a day to permit trick photography showing him changing from man to wolf. It was a tremendous ordeal for the actor, unquote. The thing they don't mention is that this happened about 6 weeks after Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein finished shooting. Chaney was on The Tonight Show once with Johnny Carson toward the end of his life, and his voice was hideously hoarse. Chaney told Johnny Carson that the reason his voice was so husky was because about 400 kids had stopped by his house one Halloween, and they all wanted to hear the Wolfman growl, and that he had done it, quote, for every one of the little boogers, and he'd screwed up his voice. That wasn't true, unfortunately. It was really throat cancer. So Chaney loved the Wolfman, and he took a lot of pride in it, but he also gave it the blame for a lot of things, from a suicide attempt to the throat cancer that killed him. I should also mention that Jack Pierce and Lon Chaney did not like each other. They had a mutual dislike. They both had abrasive personalities. Pierce was kind of a curmudgeon. He wasn't the easiest guy to get along with. And Chaney, who liked to brawl and pick on people and act like a big kid, it figures that he wouldn't like Pierce and vice versa. Bob Burns is one of the people who told me about this Pierce-Chaney situation. His theory is that Chaney Jr. probably felt a little put out because his dad was such a great makeup artist and he wasn't. And, Burns says, Pierce probably needled Chaney about that a little bit. One thing that Pierce liked to do with the Wolfman makeup was apply the yak hair and then singe it a little. That made the ends curl a little more. It kind of gave it a even look. Pierce would use a curling iron, and every so often, he'd burn the hell out of Chaney and say it was an accident. But everybody, including Chaney, I'm sure, knew better. Anyway, Pierce and Chaney fought all the time, and Pierce refused to make Chaney up after a while. House of Dracula, according to Bob Burns, is one of the movies where Pierce did not do Chaney's makeup. There are photos of Pierce working on Chaney, fiddling around with the Wolfman makeup in House of Dracula, but those were strictly for publicity. Pierce refused to even work on him, and Chaney refused to work with Pierce. Bob Burns believes, he can't be positive, but his memory is that it was a makeup man named Emil Levine who actually did the makeup on Chaney for House of Dracula, because Pierce and Chaney had this clash of personalities. They were total opposites, and they just didn't like each other. One movie that very unapologetically ripped off the Wolfman was called The Undying Monster, made by 20th Century Fox at exactly the same time as Cat People. Suddenly the studios were all trying to jump on the horror bandwagon. Undying Monster was very traditional, set in and around a spooky English castle, and it had a musical score very much in the Wolfman style. Believe it or not, it even had a Wolfman poem written in the same fashion as Even a Man Who Is Pure in Heart. The poem in The Undying Monster goes, "When stars are bright on a frosty night, beware thy bane on the rocky lane." Oh, not as good. Siodmak likes to tell the story that years and years after he wrote The Wolfman, he got a letter from some professor in Alabama pointing out to him all the similarities between The Wolfman and the classic Greek plays. Siodmak could have found that out a lot sooner if he'd just asked George Wagner. In a Saturday Evening Post article, which came out just a couple months after The Wolfman premiered, Wagner told the guy who wrote the article, My horror films have to be tragic and inevitable, just like a Greek play. Siadmak told me that George Wagner was a guy whose idea of fun was to drink beer and sing songs, so I guess Siadmak didn't take that Greek play business seriously when Wagner said it. He waited for the university guy to put it in a letter. George Wagner was born in New York City, and he graduated from the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy, intending to be a doctor. But then World War I came along, and Wagner went into the army. In the 1920s, he went to Hollywood, worked as an actor, and then later he became a screenwriter. He was also a composer who wrote over 100 songs. He was a schmaltzy pop lyricist, according to film historian Michael H. Price. Wagner wrote a lot of movies. He became a director. And in the 40s, he was one of the main forces behind the Universal horror films. He directed and or produced a lot of the best of them. Unfortunately, he wound up at the motion picture home, and he was pretty much out of it for a long, long time before he finally passed away. I made an effort to get in touch with him there, and so did Greg Mank and probably a lot of other people. But we were told, and it was true, that he wasn't in any condition to talk about his career, which is really too bad, because George Wagner probably would have been the person to talk about the Universal horror movies of the 40s. He had a set formula for them, and in fact, it might have been Wagner rather than Siadmak who came up with the idea of adding modern psychology to the horror formula, which is what they did in The Wolfman.
Yes, but it's the sign of the werewolf. They say that he can see it in the palm of the hand.
Kurt Siadmak studied Freud before he wrote this script, and the way he develops the character of Larry Talbot is very, very clever. Larry comes home after years of self-exile, and now he's so quintessentially American that he no longer seems to belong among his own people. In fact, it's easy to forget while you're watching The Wolfman that this is the house Larry Talbot grew up in, that that's the banister he slid down when he was a kid, because he acts so much like an outsider, and he's treated like an outsider. Throughout the movie, Larry has a number of defining speeches where he says things like, "I can figure out anything if you give me electric tubes and wires, things I can do with my hands." At another point, he says, "I'm no good with theory." Over and over, Siadmak has Larry remind us that he, Larry, can't relate to things you can't touch. Larry kills the wolf, and it turns out he killed Bela. Larry's scars heal overnight, and it's been well established that Larry's not going to be able to cope with any of this. For some reason, Kurt Siadmak prefers the script where Larry Gill, the American mechanic, becomes the wolfman. Siadmak says, quote, "That's even worse than an Englishman becoming a wolfman," unquote. And he thinks it would have had more impact that way. He and I are going to have to agree to disagree on that. I prefer the Wolfman the way he rewrote it, where he's got Larry Talbot, not only dealing with the werewolfism, but also with strained relations with his father and the feelings of alienation in his own hometown. As film historian Mike Brunas wrote, the festering resentment of the outwardly kindly Larry comes out in his wolf self, a marauding id terrorizing the populace.
Then I'll see to it that you can't go out to them. Come on, Larry.
Since we, the audience, know that Larry really does turn into a werewolf, we also know that all this advice he's getting from Sir John is all off base. This whole tough love approach of Sir John's isn't doing Larry a bit of good. And it's easy while watching The Wolfman to start thinking of Sir John as part of the problem. But keep in mind that Sir John is as sure as you and I are that there are no such things as werewolves. And so actually his whole attitude of, you know, come on Larry, snap out of it, is pretty realistic. It's funny that we think of characters like Sir John, who refuse to believe in monsters, as close-minded, when they're actually the most true-to-life people in the movie.
I've got to go, Larry. These people have a problem. You must make your own fight. But we'll settle this thing tonight.
Dad.
Just to finish up on the Larry Gill script, I'll tell you now how it ends, because it's different from the way the movie ends. Larry Gill and Frank Andrews don't get along at all. In the movie, Frank Andrews thinks Larry Talbot is an oddball. But in the Larry Gill script, Frank Andrews really is angry and jealous. At one point, he threatens to shoot Larry down like a dog. Well, this gives Larry Gill an idea, because now he wants to get everything over with. Larry Gill takes the silver charm that Maliva gave him. He goes into Sir John's observatory, and he uses a Bunsen burner and a melting pot, and he melts down the silver charm, and he forges it into a silver bullet. Then he kind of makes peace with Frank Andrews, but he gives him the silver bullet and tells him to use it on the wolf if the wolf attacks Gwen. Later on, out in the forest, a four-legged wolf does attack Gwen, but Frank Andrews shows up in the nick of time, and he shoots it with the silver bullet. The wounded wolf runs off, and then, a few minutes later, Larry Gill, shot, his face unseen by the camera, staggers to the edge of a pool, and he sees a monstrous wolf's face reflected in the water just before he dies. A lot of the other hunters come running over, and they see the body, and they roll it over, and it's Larry Gill. And that's how the Larry Gill script ends. It ends with nobody ever knowing if he really was a werewolf, or if it was all a hallucination on his part. Maria Uspenskaya is very antagonistic toward Claude Rains in this upcoming scene here. You'd think that she'd try to talk to him, one werewolf parent to another, and be a little understanding, but she just taunts the guy. I guess you can chalk it up to class issues. Or maybe Maliva somehow knows intuitively that Sir John is giving Larry a lot of bum advice. But I never quite figured out why she's so catty with him here. Maliva is a very strong mother figure to Larry Talbot. In fact, maybe that's why they never once mentioned Larry's real mother, to sort of underline the impression that Maliva's the closest thing to a real mother he ever had.
I told you. You're the gypsy's been filling his mind with this werewolf nonsense.
Nonsense, Sir John?
Yes. You've been preying on his gullibility.
To give you an idea how much of a factory Universal was, to give you an idea how much like a factory most of the studios were, the Wolfman wrapped around the end of November 1941, and by mid-December, only a couple weeks later, just about everybody involved with the Wolfman was already working on their next picture. Joseph Valentine and Robert Boyle were already making Saboteur with Alfred Hitchcock. That was Boyle's debut as an art director. Patrick Doles and Maria Uspenskaya were starring in Mystery of Marie Roget. And practically everybody else in the Wolfman was in the middle of making The Ghost of Frankenstein. George Wagner, Lon Chaney, Evelyn Ankers, Ralph Bellamy, Bela Lugosi, a whole lot of the supporting actors, and also a lot of the behind-the-scenes people like Jack Pierce. It was like an instant Wolfman reunion. So that's how fast this stuff was being knocked out in those days, without much time to really breathe in between pictures. Scenes for the Wolfman were being filmed in late November, but by December 9, there's another repeat shot of the Wolfman, by December 9 it was all edited and scored, and a print of the Wolfman was being shown to a Variety critic in a Universal screening room.
But I want to help him.
You'd better come with me.
Oh, no, I've got to find him.
Come with me or he will find you.
Here comes yet another repeat shot of the Wolfman. Another story that Evelyn Ankers told in that Doug McClelland book is about all the fog in the movie. She wrote that the prop men used fog machines to make that low blanket of fog about a foot off the ground, and needless to say, it was that real stinky, oily, chemical fog they used in the old days, the kind of stuff that gave everybody problems. Anyway, when the Wolfman attacks her, which is coming up now, she goes down on the ground and she had to stay down for the rest of the scene, and she passed out. The director said cut, and everybody sort of forgot about her because she was down on the floor, conked out, and completely covered by the blanket of fog. Finally, somebody remembered she'd been in the scene, and they started looking for her, and they found her. Pay attention to how roughly Lon Chaney treats Evelyn Ankers in this shot, and especially the next one. Sir John is going to show up in a minute and kill the Wolfman with the silver cane. This fits in so well with the rest of the Wolfman because it's a tragedy right across the board. Larry gets killed by his own father with the silver cane Larry gave him. He really does come to a predestined end, as Maliva had predicted. One old script had Sir John shooting the Wolfman, but the silver cane is much better. It kind of brings the whole story full circle to have Larry killed with the cane next to what looks like the very same tree where Larry killed the wolf. Reportedly, Claude Rains got a little carried away when he started belting Lon Chaney with the cane. Rains had a stuntman during part of this fight, and probably Chaney did too, but supposedly Rains really did whack Chaney full force with the cane. They gave Chaney an ice pack, and didn't help. He had a black eye, and he was all swollen up, and they had to send him home. The guys who wrote film reviews for daily newspapers did not give horror movies a fair shake in the old days. Most of them saw each new horror movie as an excuse to set aside everything they knew about writing a constructive review and just be nasty or comical, or both. On the Wolfman, the New York World Telegram, the success of films of this kind depends upon their suspense and eeriness. The Wolfman lacks both. Baltimore Evening Sun, it isn't Lon Chaney's intention to be comical, but you can't help laughing. Portland Oregon News, it takes a lot of imagination to get more than a laugh out of the Wolfman. Lon Chaney is passing through his Don King phase right there. The Baltimore Sun, the writing and direction are lamentably bad and the acting is universally wooden, etc., etc. By the way, the thing you see in every werewolf movie except the Wolfman is the moon. Not once do they show the moon. And also no one ever says full moon in the Wolfman. Those things were rectified in the sequels. In that Val Lewton article I mentioned before, something else he wrote is 100% correct. He wrote that no type of picture reacts so favorably to better staging, better casts, more time and money spent on quality than the horror film. Quote, horror films must be filmed carefully. They must be just right, unquote. The Wolfman was done just right, no matter what Val Lewton might have said about it, and it was a huge hit. It went out on a double bill with a picture called The Mad Doctor of Market Street with Lionel Atwill, and within just a few months it had made $1 million. And once it made its first million, George Wagner got a diamond ring for his wife, and the executive producer got a $10,000 bonus. Kurt Siodmak asked for a $25 raise, and Universal said no. The Wolfman makes a powerful appeal to our imaginations, wrote film historian Michael Brunis. The tragic story of Lawrence Talbot is basic yet compelling and classically structured. Critics may be reluctant to include the film on the list of definitive horror classics, but its popularity and influence demand its inclusion. I'm Tom Weaver. Thank you for listening.